I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along on this Thursday, June the 21st. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's announcement this week that he is leaving the Republican Party is prompting many to believe he is setting himself up for a possible independent run for president. Yesterday, Bloomberg downplayed the possibility, saying he loved being mayor and that his state already has two candidates running for president, Rudy Giuliani and Hillary Clinton, but he didn't rule it out and said things like, "The more people who run for office, the better." And when pressed,
"If everybody in the world was dead and I was the only one alive yet, sure. I mean, come on. Not, no."
We'll talk about the possibility of an independent run by Bloomberg and what he would probably face as a independent candidate or a third-party candidate. We'll also talk about the obstacles and advantages facing third-party candidates in general. And we'll wonder if you are disappointed with the current field of candidates in the Republican and Democratic parties and whether you have your eye on a third-party or third-party candidate. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Toll-free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890-263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Dennis Goldford. He is a professor of politics and the director of the program in law, politics, and society at Drake University, and he's author of the book, The American Constitution and the Debate Over Originalism. Good morning.
Good morning.
So why does Michael Bloomberg sever ties with the Republican Party now if he's not considering an independent run?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Bloomberg, you have to remember, has been a lifelong Democrat and actually switched registrations and became a Republican, back in 2001, I think it was, because he would face less of a primary battle to get on the ballot for the mayor's race in New York. So he became a Republican as a matter of electoral convenience rather than ideological conviction.
So is too much being made out of this then?
Well, in some ways, I think yes. Bloomberg is not somebody who's known very far beyond New York or perhaps Washington. And in New York, I'm thinking politically and Wall Street, since, of course, he's made a fortune with his financial news empire. It's not as though he's been somebody out there up to now articulating some missing viewpoint on the national American political scene. But we've been talking about the Republican candidates and the Democratic candidates almost to death at this point, this early. So he's a new face. On the other hand, I think, at least in terms of Bloomberg's possible supporters or the people trying to advance his candidacy, they are on to something, and that's this, I think. His concerns about hyper-partisanship resonate to some extent with the American people, although it didn't get Bill Bradley very far in 2000. Back in 1992, E.J. Dionne, the columnist for the Washington Post, who appears in various venues, wrote a popular book talking about various things a political scientist had known for quite some time. And the book was called Why Americans Hate Politics. And Dionne's argument, which again reflected pretty much conventional political science understanding, was that increasingly candidates or potential candidates kept talking to the political activists who were at the ideological extremes. So potential Republican candidates talked to the hard right of the Republican Party, and Democratic candidates talk to the hard left, most liberal elements of the Democratic Party. And according to Dionne, nobody was talking to the great mass of the American people who tend to be in the middle. And the folks behind a potential Bloomberg candidacy seem to be suggesting there's fertile ground there, and that's what they may attempt to plow.
And is that really where Bloomberg is, in that middle?
Well, in some ways, he tends to be. I mean, in a way, broadly speaking, most Americans on social issues tend to be fairly moderate, and on fiscal issues tend to be a little bit more conservative. Well, Republicans, at least until this last Republican set of Congresses who became big spenders themselves, Republicans had always tried to be fiscally conservative but they were also, in social issues, extremely conservative, dominated by their social and religious elements of their party. Democrats were more socially and religiously moderate to liberal, but they weren't fiscally conservative. They were more fiscally liberal. So both parties had elements of what seemed to concern the great middle, but neither party accomplished that overall.
Yeah. All right. So Bloomberg, you know, maybe isn't setting himself up for a run for president. But then why is he on this kind of like a speaking tour that's been compared to a presidential campaign? He issued his statements, you know, from California yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Well, everybody likes a venue, number one, in which people take what you say with some seriousness. But also, you have to remember in California that it's still hard to say Governor Schwarzenegger has, you know, he ran, first of all, in more strictly Republican terms, and he did get elected in that odd recall. But Schwarzenegger himself was in a more fiscally conservative and socially moderate to liberal. Schwarzenegger never would have gotten through a Republican primary in California if he had gone about it that traditional route, because in social issues he was considered too liberal by the Republican base. But because of the peculiarities of that recall election, he did get elected. He started then to govern from the right and just got creamed in California. And then after he lost on his support for a number of referenda that they put on the ballot in California a couple of years ago, he began to govern much more from the center, and it's made him very popular out there. And that's the sort of thing that Bloomberg may have, or at least his supporters may have in mind.
Yeah. Well, Bloomberg may not have the name recognition as the other candidates, but he does have a lot going for him in terms of, what is he, the 44th richest man in the country?
Well, he has a tremendous amount of money. You hear various figures. The one I heard most recently was he's worth $5 billion, and he could be self-financing. But you've got to remember, I mean, that makes him, in a sense, able to fund his own campaign, as I said, and not worry about all the time it takes to raise money. But you have to remember that in American politics, money is necessary but not sufficient. I mean, remember the famous statement from President Phil Gramm, and of course we have such president, who said in 1996, "I've got the best friend in politics a person could have, and that's ready money." Well, Gramm didn't survive the Iowa caucuses. So money's necessary but it's not sufficient. If money's what fuels a campaign, money's like gasoline. You can have all the gasoline in the world, but if your car's not very good, it's not going to do you much good.
Yeah, and Ross Perot had plenty of cash.
That's right. That's right. Now, Perot did, in fact, ride a certain wave of discontent at that point, which enabled him, of course, to do very well in 1992 in terms of the popular vote percentage. He had the largest percentage of the popular vote in modern times, going back to and except for Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. But of course, at the same time, he didn't get any electoral votes. But certainly Perot had a lot of money, and it got him a hearing, it got him some popular votes. But after that one-time fluke election, perhaps, he disappeared from the political scene.
It says he got, what, 19% of the popular vote?
Right, in 1992.
And that's about as good as a third-party candidate has ever done?
Well, in modern times, Theodore Roosevelt got 27% of the popular vote. Wisconsin's own Bob La Follette in 1924 got just under 17%. But if we think in terms of modern times, particularly since 1948, as much as people tend to be discontented with the two major parties have taken over 90% of the popular vote every year, except for George Wallace in 1968, who got 13.5% of the popular vote, and Perot in 1992. So the Republicans and Democrats may be the source of a lot of discontent, but they still take over 19%, over 90% of the popular vote.
Some are saying that Ross Perot could have done a whole lot better than that, targeted states that he might have gotten some of the electoral vote if he didn't sort of implode and go a little batty.
Well, there's a question, of course, of whether that really was possible. I mean, Perot, in a way, rode a concern that Washington was out of touch and that Congress didn't have its fiscal house in order and other sorts of things. You had a weak Republican incumbent, George Bush the first. So it was, you know, the confluence of events, I think, that led to some of his success there. But he didn't ride some kind of highly passionate wave on the part of a significant constituency who thought that their concerns weren't being addressed. The best example of that is the Wallace movement in 1968. He was a regional candidate, so he had a focus. Wallace did get 46 electoral votes in 1968 with a lower percent. You know, he had only two-thirds of the popular vote that Ross Perot did, but Ross Perot had no electoral votes. So it all depends upon where you get these. Mm-hmm. And it's the same. It's, in a sense, it's easier to be a regional candidate who's running because of some particularly passionate concern on the part of people who believe that the major parties aren't representing that. And for Wallace, it was this sort of conservative or right-wing populism that, in fact, after 68, Republicans adopted.
We're talking with Dennis Goldford, a professor of politics and the director of the program in law, politics, and society at Drake University, talking about third-party candidates and the race for president. Third-party candidates face an uphill battle when running for president. We're looking at the obstacles in place and wondering whether New York City's mayor, Michael Bloomberg, might be poising himself to enter the 2008 race. The other day, he announced that he is withdrawing from the Republican Party and becoming an independent. 1-800-642-1234, our toll-free number. If you have a thought or a question about this, we welcome your calls for our guest. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Do you want to see someone like Michael Bloomberg running for president as an independent? Do you have any thoughts on other third-party candidates you'd like to see in this race? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up after 6, it's On Point. And On Point, we'll welcome in presidential candidate Ron Paul. The Texas Republican is less than a long shot as a presidential contender, but he doesn't mince his words on the GOP stage, and he will be the guest On Point after 6 o'clock. We're talking about third-party candidates and the race for president this hour, prompted in part by New York City Mayor's Michael Bloomberg's announcement that he is severing his ties with the GOP and becoming an independent. Many are saying that this is setting himself up for a possible independent run for the presidency. What do you think of that? What's your reaction to that? What questions do you have about third-party candidates? Our guest studies third-party candidacies. He is Dennis Goldford, a professor of politics at Drake University. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let's take our first call, since I just talked about Ron Paul being on Point. Kevin in Milwaukee.
Hi, Joy. Well, I'm absolutely thrilled to hear that Congressman Paul is going to be on later this afternoon, and I sure will tune in to hear what he has to say. But since your guest mentioned that there could possibly be room for somebody who is a social moderate and a fiscal conservative, and it sounds like we're sort of analyzing the idea that the person who would fit this bill is has some independence from the two-party system. I thought Ron Paul fit that bill just perfectly, and I'd like to get you and your guests' thoughts on that. I'll take your comments off the air.
Yeah. Wasn't Ron Paul, didn't he run as a libertarian in the past, Dennis Goldford?
Yes, he has. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most libertarians take the view, if I can put it colloquially, that, you know, government should stay out of the bedroom and out of the boardroom. Mm-hmm. Democrats tend to say government can be in the boardroom, you know, regulate economic matters, but should stay out of the bedroom. Republicans tend to say Republicans should stay out of the boardroom and it's fine to be in the bedroom. But Ron Paul in the recent debates actually has talked about being anti-abortion rights, which is not typically a libertarian position. But he has run as a libertarian in the past. The libertarians, however, tend to get maybe a 0.5% to 1% of the popular vote in any given election. We have to remember that when we talk about third parties, that typically, the last time a third party actually displaced one of the two major parties was 150 years ago. The Republican Party, born in around 1854, roughly, displaced the Whig Party. But that's the last time a third party has actually displaced one of the two major parties. Typically, third parties exert their influence by articulating, again, a demand or a concern or a grievance that a significant proportion of the population believes isn't being addressed by one of the two major parties. And then one of the two major parties essentially takes that issue and runs with it, takes it away, steals it from the third party. So the Democrats did that in 1896 to the Populist Party. The Republicans did that post-1968 to the George Wallace movement. The Republicans did that again in 94 and 96 in 2000 to the Perot movement. So the whole system structurally is built for two major parties, and third parties face substantial legal and structural disadvantages.
Yeah, like what?
Well, for example, if you're a candidate of either of the two major parties, you automatically are on the ballot in all of the states. If you're a third-party candidate, depending upon which party that is, you usually have to go state by state in a petition drive to get yourself on the ballot. That takes time. That takes money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and but Bloomberg has the money. But
it still takes a lot of time when you need to be doing other things.
Right. Lou in Oconomowoc is with us next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment was, and my first question is to you, the professors. My feeling on the fact that this man, Mr. Bloomberg, entering the race would affect one candidate more than another. My last comment here is that I looked at Mr. Nader in the 2000 election and how he had promised or said that he wouldn't enter a race or a state where there was a possibility of affecting an election. Well, he went back and reneged on that completely, and I have these friends that are third-party candidates, and I appreciate a third party, but you know what? I look at these guys, and I look at them almost like spoilers. Mr. Bloomberg says he's more Republican than anything. If I'm a very wealthy man in this country, and if I want to really affect an election, like Mr. Nader did, and they deny it up and down to this day, I'll tell you what, enter the election, and I can set the course of a nation as Mr. Nader did in 2000. I just wonder what your comments are on that.
Well, that's it. I mean, one of the obstacles for a third-party candidate is that at least post the 1850s, it's going to be a Republican or a Democrat who's going to be elected. I mean, that's almost certain, barring some sort of electoral catastrophe. It's going to be a Republican or a Democrat. And so third, because we don't have a poor proportional system whereby if your third party gets 20% of the vote, it'll at least get 20% of the legislative seats, something like that. We have a winner-take-all system, so whoever gets the most wins the whole ball of wax. Third parties don't have a chance there, and they deal with the question of whether, in fact, their supporters are wasting their votes. That's what the major parties always tell them. But also, in terms of affecting the particular parties in question or candidates in question, the two main parties, if, say, a state like California or New York would be the state possibly, and we'd have the odd circumstance if it were Giuliani and Clinton, of three candidates from New York, which would be remarkable. If Giuliani and Clinton and Bloomberg were all running, Bloomberg, to have any kind of support, possibly would have more in California and New York, which are New York bastions, and which are Democratic bastions. And so a candidacy like that, if he had any traction, I think would be more threatening to a Democratic candidate than a Republican candidate.
I did hear some speculation yesterday that, that Bloomberg was on the sidelines now waiting to see who might be the likely nominees in the two major parties. For instance, if John Edwards as the Democrat and Mitt Romney as the Republican, then he could have that run in the middle.
Well, but again, it's a question of who will show up to vote. I mean, the Karl Rove strategy ever since the 2000 election was that there aren't many people in the middle. people tend to be Republicans or Democrats, so that's why the whole Rove strategy for the Bush administration was to govern from the right. In other words, they said, activate your base, don't worry about the middle. I don't know if that was accurate. I consider the 2006 elections the kind of revenge of the center. There aren't many pure independents, but in terms of being liberal or conservative, most people are in the middle. That may be what the supporters of a Bloomberg candidacy are counting on. But again, he's not a well-known figure. He's not a charismatic figure. The question is how far he could ride some wave of popular discontent with the two major parties.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about Ralph Nader's run. That was, I seem to remember that in some states he was on the Green Party ballot, and some he was an independent. And,
right.
And,
well, in 2004, he ran as an independent because the Greens didn't have anything to do with him then. He got only a tenth of a percent of the popular vote in 2004. In 2000, famously, of course, or infamously, he ran on the Green Party ballot and got 2.7%. But the key, of course, is where you get it, as we saw with Florida. I mean, the system is very complex between the popular vote and the electoral vote. I've had at times to try to explain our system to people from other countries coming in to try to understand it, and that's a real challenge to explain that difference. But, you know, the Nader approach has been what was the approach that tends to be the approach of whether the really deeply conservative folks on that extreme or the really deeply liberal folks on that extreme. And that is, to use the old phrase, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two major parties. You know, Nader thought both parties are essentially agents of corporate capitalism, so it makes no difference. Arguably, you know, intelligence is being able to make appropriate distinctions. And, you know, I always tell students, no matter what your particular political values may be, one of the two major candidates is always less bad than the other one from your perspective. And again, the Nader candidacy thought, you know, pox on both your houses, and they actually elected the person who was further from their views than of course, the other alternative in 2000.
Yeah. And Ralph Nader is kind of on the sidelines right now. He's not ruling out a third-party run this time around.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But I think, as 2000 showed, a lot of former or potential supporters of his are pretty well done with him.
Mm-hmm. Ross Perot ended up really being the spoiler and electing President Clinton, wasn't he?
Well, you know, there were some studies back then that suggested that even without Perot, Bill Clinton would have won, that there was enough dissatisfaction with the Bush administration. The conventional wisdom, of course, especially among Republicans, is that he was the spoiler, to be sure. We have to remember that, like Richard Nixon in 1968, Bill Clinton, in both of his elections, never received a majority of the popular vote. Clinton had about 43% roughly both times, maybe 46% the second time. Again, because of the Electoral College system, it's a question of where you get it. But so we had, in both cases, of President Clinton being a minority candidate in that regard, in terms of the popular vote.
Remind me the circumstances of John Anderson's run.
Well, we have to remember that the country was extremely discontent. You know, the standard measures people use, and this is what's hurting the Bush administration now, are that polling question, basically, do you think the country's on the right track? And a relatively large proportion of people believe that now. Well, an extremely large proportion of the people believe that in 1979, 1980. The sense between the hostages in Iran, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the 15% mortgage rates and interest rates, things like that, there really was a sense back then of things being out of control. Now, the Carter White House in 1979 were salivating at the thought of running against Ronald Reagan because they thought, he's obviously just too extreme. That's just another Goldwater. But people weren't happy with Jimmy Carter. A lot of independents, moderate Republicans, feared that Reagan would be another Goldwater, or they didn't like his policies. So you had the John Anderson boomlet, so to speak. Well, Anderson captured no electoral votes. He had about just under 7% of the popular vote, But Anderson, I don't recall tipping any states to Reagan that would have gone to Carter otherwise, or vice versa. Again, we have to remember that in American politics, since 1952, with the exception of 64, independents have always tended to vote for the Republican candidate. A Democrat, since 1952, with the exception of Goldwater in 64, has never received a majority of the independent vote. So Democrats have got a tough row to hoe there in that regard. But independents haven't terribly hurt Republicans, with the possible exception of Perot in 1992.
Our next caller is Diane in Madison. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just have a comment to make. With so many people running on the Republican and Democratic side, I'm just wondering why Michael Bloomberg at this time would, and not being a seasoned person, and knowing, excuse me, that he, being the mayor of New York, is so far from being a president, would run for the presidential candidacy. And second of all, what is his passion that is not of the other candidates as to why he's running? And I'm wondering if your guest could answer that question. Thank you.
All right, we'll see.
Sure. First of all, you have to remember that Rudy Giuliani isn't even a current mayor. He's a former mayor. So that's certainly not stopping him. Of course, his reputation is for leadership during 9/11, although there are criticisms that he left the city woefully unprepared for 9/11, with the knowledge that they had from the earlier attack in the early 90s on the Trade Center and other areas. So he's not immune to criticism there, but his reputation, of course, is being a leader. And certainly Bloomberg doesn't have that, as the caller suggests. That's certainly the case. Again, I think Bloomberg thinks that it's not that there's a particular issue out there that's not addressed, but there's a particular constituency, which is the great middle, that's being ignored, at least according to the Bloomberg folks. He's not himself said that directly very much yet. I think that, yes, there's a huge number of people running on both sides because there's no obvious next person in line. I mean, Republicans tend to be more royalist. They tend to believe that the next person in line is the person who should get the nomination. But there's nobody obviously there now. I suggested, perhaps even here on Wisconsin Public Radio last year, that nobody was going to run as a Bush Republican. You're going to have all this return to being a Reagan Republican, which you tend to see in the debates now. And on the Democratic side, you know, the nature of our political system is such that it's hard for there to be a kind of what the British would call shadow prime minister. In other words, there's no obvious way that there's a clear, obvious leader of the out party, the party that doesn't control the White House. So you see all these folks contending for that leadership role, but nobody striking a majority chord at this point. So we will probably, you know, after the fact say, well, of course, now we see why someone on each side got the nomination, the person who did. But right now, there's no way to predict that. And the Republicans, you know, waiting for Godot, waiting for Fred Thompson, they think Thompson is out there. Fred Thompson, I think, translates politically into the phrase, none of the above. They're just not happy with their field, and they hope he's the great person who would be a next Reagan. But that remains to be seen as well. So it's a very fluid, very fragmented field.
Thank you, Diane, for the call. We have open lines if you want to talk about New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg leaving the Republican Party and setting himself up perhaps for a independent bid for the presidency. We're talking about that development this week and how third-party candidates fare in general. They face an uphill battle when they are running for president. We wonder if you think that it ought to be made easier somehow for third-party candidates to get on the ballot or to make any inroads. Wonder if you think third-party candidates are spoilers when it comes to the race for president. We wonder if you'd like to see other candidates get involved as third-party candidates. 1-800-642-1234. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or are you perfectly happy with the field of Republicans and field of Democrats that you have to choose from right now? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. A new nonprofit was launched this week that aims to bring consumers and companies together in the fight against global warming. After 9, Kathleen will talk with the director of Climate Counts. That's after 9. After 10, Kathleen and her guest will discuss the psychology of clutter. I'll have to listen to that one. We're talking about third-party candidates and the race for president with Dennis Goldford. He is a professor of politics and the director of the program in Law, Politics, and Society at Drake University. He is the author of The American Constitution and the Debate Over Originalism. Our number, if you have a question about third-party politics, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Before we go back to the phones, Professor Goldford, I wanted to ask you a little bit about many of those who advocate for third-party candidates and third-party politics say that we really need to change the way we vote in this country to have, like, instant runoff voting. Do you agree?
Well, that's a tough one. I mean, we have to remember, again, that for the most part, with the exception of some southern states, it's not that somebody has to get a majority. Somebody simply has to get a plurality. So in a 3-, 4-, 5-person race, the important thing is who gets the most, not whether somebody gets a majority. And that's where there's this disadvantage for third parties, because they almost never will get the greatest number of votes in a particular state. And as I said, it's winner-take-all, so if you don't get the most votes, you get nothing. A further difficulty with that is whatever changes you're talking about would have to be voted on by members of state legislatures to a great extent, because they tend to control the electoral process. Congress can set the time and date of federal elections, but basically the electoral machinery is in the hands of the states. Well, who are these folks sitting in state legislatures and governor's offices?
Yeah,
they're Republicans and Democrats. So why would they vote to commit some political suicide?
Yeah. Third-party candidates also have a very difficult time getting in the debates. Ross Perot did, but Ralph Nader did not, and most do not.
That's the problem. I mean, there's a catch-22 in it. You might say, well, you're not doing well enough in the polling to be included in debates, but then you could say, but if I were included in the debates, I might do better in the polling. It's that sort of catch-22. Various organizations, news organizations, League of Women Voters, depending on who it is, always have this tough question about whom to include, because there's a huge number of third parties out there, depending upon the state you're talking about. You know, there's the Constitution Party, the Natural Law Party, the America First Party. There are a couple of Green parties. There's a whole array of Socialist Party, Socialist Labor Party, Socialist Workers Party, quite a number of right-wing parties. They all might clamor to say, hey, we should be included as well. And it's always, and of course they tend not to be, but it's, you know, how far do you include a Libertarian Party candidate? Well, of course, Ron Paul now runs as a Republican. So that's a very difficult situation, as we've seen with the simple Democratic and Republican candidates. When you have 8 or 10 people on a stage, you just get this cacophony, and, you know, what do you really hear from them? That's
right,
the difficulty.
Right. Judy in Green Bay joins us now. Hi, Judy.
Good morning.
Morning.
Say, I do believe it's far too difficult for third-party candidates to be involved. I would love to see more. I just believe people are tired of electing people who really don't end up speaking for us. They end up speaking for a party. And I think we see third-party candidates as, you know, maybe people that can think more for themselves, and therefore they are able to speak more for us as opposed to speaking for a party. And I was very interested in what he said about how these changes would have to be made by state legislators, because I feel that I would like to see more third-party candidates involved in state races. I'd feel that we as voters would benefit I don't know what the solutions are. I agree, the debates, the polling, it's a vicious cycle. I don't know the solution, but as a voter, it's difficult. You feel like you vote for a candidate, but then they get into office, and when push comes to shove, they're really representing a party as opposed to representing you as a voter. So I do agree that we need more third-party candidates, and that I feel it is too difficult for them to be involved. I think we would benefit greatly from having those people involved.
And Professor Goldford?
Well, third parties certainly have more of a chance at a state level than they do at the national level. You know, Wisconsin has that wonderful history of the Progressive Party. You have the Democratic Farmer and Labor Party in Minnesota. You had, of course, I think the Liberal Party in New York's gone out of business, but you have the Conservative Party, the Right to Life Party. There was around 1980, there was this wonderful party out in Oregon, I think it was, called the Owl Party, started by a couple of guys in a bar who said their slogan was, "We don't give a hoot." So you get this whole menagerie of parties out there, serious and not serious. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think something that a serious third party may count on is the fact that, but it hasn't been realized as potential yet, is that and the best chance for a serious third party to come along, at least on a national basis, is that you have to remember that when we talk about elections considered from a national perspective, we barely get over 50% of eligible voters actually showing up at the polls. In other words, there's a huge number of people out there who don't vote at all. Even in a presidential year when voting rates go up, but again, barely over 50%, in those same races, only on average about 44% of eligible voters actually cast a vote in congressional races. And in midterm elections like 06, 02, we'll have it in 2010, you get on a national average only about 37 or 38% of eligible voters actually turning out to vote. So there's a huge number of folks out there who aren't voting at all or certainly aren't voting regularly, and perhaps the hope for if somebody's really interested in a third party, whether on a statewide or national basis, is to do something in some way brings back into the actual electorate folks who have been remaining outside of that for all this time.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, and maybe Judy just doesn't get a lot of, you know, there's not a lot of media attention of these third party candidates, but we have all these, you know, the Constitution Party and all of these candidates, third party candidates on the ballot in Wisconsin during presidential years, because it's not that difficult to get on the ballot in Wisconsin. So they are out there running, but they're not at least garnering a whole lot of attention.
Right. And again, if we had a proportional system and we were voting for a legislature, you know, we vote for individuals, but if we were voting for a legislature, you could say, okay, again, if a party gets 6% of the vote nationwide, then they'll get 6% of the seats in the legislature. Germany has a kind of dual system, but they have a 5% hurdle because of their concern about the Weimar Republic fragmentation of parties. But if a party gets at least 5%, they get some representation in the legislature. But again, think for a moment that the race that comes to mind for me is in New York in 1980. The sitting Republican senator was Jacob Javits, and he was a liberal Republican, the old Rockefeller Republican type. And he was challenged in the Republican primary by Alphonse D'Amato. Well, D'Amato beat Javits in that primary for the Republican nomination, but Javits didn't go away. He ran on the Liberal Party ballot as a third-party candidate, and the Democrats, Elizabeth Holtzman, ran. And D'Amato won only 40% of the overall vote, but he won more than everybody else. So despite the fact that 60% wanted somebody else, he became the senator because he had a plurality. And so you always have that particular issue. But we don't have, it's winner-take-all again, as I've emphasized, we don't have a proportional system so that if a third party constantly had about a 20, 25% support, even 15% support nationwide, there's no way to get into the legislature.
Yeah. Scott in La Crosse joins us now. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Good morning to you both. My question is, I never am sure, particularly when you have a large field of candidates, how many are really serious about having a chance or think they're think they have a serious chance at becoming president, and how many really are just trying to get a high enough profile that they might be considered for a vice presidential bid. I would like to think that that's the case with the former governor of Wisconsin, who really is, I think, politically savvy enough maybe to understand that, you know, he's probably not going to be a president, but maybe somebody would tap him for vice president. So my question is it possible at all, do you think, that that's what Bloomberg is in fact doing, is getting himself in a position where somebody to balance a ticket out could think that, you know, the mayor of New York with a lot of money and some good, well, hopefully good ideas would be a good balance on a ticket?
Well, this is just a gut sense of mine rather than something based on some sort of systematic study, but I have the sense that the process of running for president, if you're going to do it seriously, is so arduous, it's so difficult, it's so painful in various ways in a personal and political sense that nobody runs to be vice president. You run because you want to be the top of the ticket. Actually, once there's a nominee for the top of the ticket, that person makes almost a personal choice based upon concerns that he or she may have, and that choice is almost, I can't recall the last time a person's nominee was rejected by the convention, a nominee for the vice president. So, you know, Tommy Thompson's got experience as a governor of Wisconsin. He was secretary for HHS. He's got a resume in that regard in terms of being a potential vice president. I don't think running for president is something that he needs to do to be considered for that. But it's so serendipitous in terms of who the nominee would be. It's that person's personal choice rather than the convention. I mean, the convention technically is the one that makes that nomination, but all they're doing is ratifying what the nominee for the presidency has made as a personal choice.
Thanks very much, Scott, for the call. Jim in La Crosse, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I used to strongly believe in the concept that any third party, a vote for it, did represent a spoiling effect. But now I've come to realize that I believe both the two major parties are spoiling the system. They represent their parties, they represent their own financial interests, and they represent a very select constituency who unfortunately have bought them off. I don't think I need to read the book Outrage. I think I understand what's going on pretty well already. I think that the any third party attempt is going to need a very, very strong candidate, and maybe somebody like a Colin Powell that will galvanize interest in that, you know, third party attempt at wrestling power from the other two parties.
What do you think?
Well, you know, sometimes I think I'd like to be like Superman. I'd really like to fly, but gravity, you know, by myself, but gravity is such that it's not going to happen, so I just have to get used to it, even if I'm not thrilled with it. And our whole political system is built around two parties. And I guess part of me says, get used to it. The caller's concern, of course, is precisely the Nader kind of concern in 2000. But I can't believe, so I would say that I think the two major parties are thrilled, but it's like the fact that I'm not going to fly. It's just, that's just the way it is. And I can't believe that whatever the caller's political values, moral values, concerns, I can't believe that one of the two candidates is not further, well, that will get, is further away from his values than the other candidate. It's always a matter of saying, you know, who's the lesser evil? We may not like that, but that's the nature of politics. And you can object to the two parties by trying to run a third-party candidacy, or you can object to the two parties as conservatives did in the late 1950s, early 1960s, by attempting to take over one of the two major parties. I mean, the Republican Party was anchored in the Northeast. It was a Rockefeller, moderate to liberal Republican Party. A higher proportion of Republicans in 64 voted for the Civil Rights Act than Democrats did in 1964 and 65 for the Voting Rights Act. But conservatives essentially took over the Republican Party as opposed to running a third party. And I think in some ways, given the structural disadvantages that hurt third parties, If you really don't like the two major parties, it seems to me your better alternative is to try to take over one of the two major parties rather than to run a third party.
I watched someone on television yesterday who was booing Hillary Clinton when she spoke at the Take Back America conference, more of a liberal movement, and she made some comments about the war in Iraq that were booed.
Mm-hmm.
And this person was asked, well, if Hillary Clinton becomes the Democratic nominee, will you support her? And the reply was, I don't know. I'm going to see who's running on the Green Party if that's the case. I just want to comment on that.
Well, again, that's the pox on both your houses, Nader kind of argument from 2000. I mean, I would think in terms of these peculiar, awful circumstances with the Iraq situation, whoever is president at noon Eastern time on January 20th of 2009, Democrat or Republican, is going to get us out of Iraq. I mean, there's no question about that. There's no question about that. But again, I mean, given the general political orientation of Nader folks, they have to have realized, those who supported him in 2000, that if there had been a President Gore, there certainly would have been probably military action in Afghanistan. There would not have been an invasion of Iraq. And political parties, and especially candidates, always have to deal with this fight between purists and pragmatists. Sometimes in Europe they call them realists and fundamentalists. But on the Democratic side, it's always the pure liberals versus the pragmatic liberals. And the conservative Republicans, it's the pure conservatives and the pragmatic conservatives. I mean, even Ronald Reagan, talking to conservatives, had to say, and I think I've got the number right in my memory, Reagan had to say once, somebody who supports me 80% of the time is not my enemy. Well, if you're a purist, you're either with me 100% of the time or you're my enemy. And there's always this difficulty in political parties, and candidates hate purists because politics is about compromise and negotiation, and that goes completely against any kind of purity.
Yeah. We only have a minute left. Your prediction, do you think Bloomberg's going to do this or not?
If he's serious that he wants to do it to win and not to be a spoiler, I can't see at this point, given the lay of the land rationally, how he could decide to do this.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Always a pleasure.
Dennis Goldford is a professor of politics and the director of the program in Law, Politics, and Society at Drake University, author of the book The American Constitution and the Debate Over Originalism. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour. Thanks to Leo Duran for on-air production. Thank you for listening and for calling in. If you would like a CD copy of this or any of our talk shows, please call the radio store. 1-800-747-7444. You can also listen to our talk shows through your computer. They are archived on our website, wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.